What do you want to do? Work. Which kind of work do you need to do? Creative. How does this creativity thrive?
Welcome to the Getting Simple podcast. Getting Simple is about simplifying your life and doing less better. Hi everyone, I'm Nono Martinez Alonso and this is the Getting Simple podcast. Today I'm thrilled to introduce you to Antonio García Guerra. Hi Guerra, how are you today?
How's it going, Nono? Thank you very much for having me here.
We're currently in Malaga, Spain, and Antonio will be flying back to Oxford in a few days.
Yep, on the 7th.
Antonio did a PhD on nanotechnology applied to medicine at the University of Oxford. Can you tell me a bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I am a biotechnologist by training. I did biotechnology in Barcelona. That was my undergrad. And I was always interested in the concept of engineering, but more from a biological perspective, and particularly for applications in medicine. And the way I ended up doing this PhD that you talked about was after my, or before finishing my undergrad, I went to the United States. It was kind of a bit of a lucky thing. I wanted to do some summer internship somewhere with an attempt of not only learning English, but also improving my science and everything. And basically, I won the lottery. I sent so many emails. I don't know. I think it's almost 100 or something like that, but very close to it. And tons of them, they basically said no. And I think that out of 10 responses I got, 9 of them were like, no, I'm sorry, I don't have a space for you, except for a lucky shot that even still, he told me no. But instead of that, maybe he saw an opportunity over here and he offered me the possibility to go to his lab for 6 to 9 months. This PI is Ali Karim Hosseini. He is a major player in the tissue engineering and biomaterials research field. And at the time, he was based in Boston in Harvard Medical School. That's basically the whole thing, was basically the lottery bit. And I just went there to learn as an intern, to learn more about biomaterials, tissue engineering, applications of biomaterials to drug delivery. And because of my interest over there, as I stayed there for a whole year, before going back home, I tried to extend my stay in the States, particularly in Boston, because I understood context is very important to growth, and I also have a lot of friends. So I try to remain in one of the amazing universities that the city has to offer. And I applied to MIT as a visiting student. Also, again, crossing my fingers with the idea of like hopefully winning the lottery again. And I did. I think that was all thanks to the letters of recommendation that my PI wrote for me. And I stay there to finish my undergrad for another year. And it was because with all this context, with all this new input I had on what was possible, what was not, the new experiences I had, because they actually gave me a lot of freedom to do my own, to work and to manage my own self and everything, I went back to Spain. And when I was deciding which was going to be my next step, which at the time was trying to go back to the US to start a PhD there, I said, well, you know, the email strategy worked, so let's see if it works again. So I did it again to try to get join a lab in which I could learn more or even do a master's so I could have more chances of getting a PhD in the US. And by doing this time, I came across my PhD advisor, Professor Andrew Taberfield at the University of Oxford. So he works on DNA nanotechnology. And I asked him if I could join his lab, because this idea of like mixing nanotechnology with a biomolecule such as DNA, kind of like, I thought it was a pretty interesting idea to be at the interface of different disciplines and learn more. And I went to talk to him, and during an interview for a master's program, he actually offered me the opportunity to join his lab as a Marie Curie PhD student participating in a ITN for training new students, which basically I kind of felt that it was kind of like a once in a lifetime opportunity. So of course I said yes, and I remained in his lab working on my PhD until very recently.
Yeah, so that's great. I'm surprised about how these opportunities came to you, and I mean how you had to look for them, how you ended up being lucky in some way, right? Yeah. What were you expecting that, or what was your main objective at the beginning?
Well, I completely wasn't. I mean, of course, I wasn't expecting this. Like, my background will never really even imagine that I would reach these places, particularly because like being in a country such as Spain, thinking of these overseas elite universities, like you think of like something of the movies and something that, I mean, at least it wasn't ingrained even as a possibility for me. So no, I wasn't expecting that at all. But I do now, looking a bit back on it, it kind of makes sense. Like, you know, if you have to work for you have to give an opportunity to your opportunities to appear. And if you don't try, you the answer will always be no.
So in our previous conversation, I felt that to perform at your maximum intellectual capacity in the lab, in your work and research, you needed other habits and activities to support your life. Some sort of physical, emotional, and maybe informational pillars to support a highly demanding mental activity. Can you tell us about those habits?
Yes, that is actually something I've been focusing more recently. At the beginning, I didn't have any of this. I would say that looking a bit back, I realized that I'm a bit of a driven person. So I tend to obsess onto things. And during my PhD, and even now, I'm still spending a lot of time in the lab. And for that, at the beginning, it was tougher because, like, you know, you need to find the way in which you're comfortable with. But now, after introducing these things you were talking about, I feel that everything is so much better, and I wish I have done it earlier. So I basically do, I've noticed about, as you said, these three topics, sports, emotions, and information. So I think all of them are interconnected, and it's something I've been thinking about it at all, these holistic approaches. But for sports, I do boxing at the moment. I like it very much, even though I'm still struggling with the part of getting punched in the face. But, you know, it's part of the business. But I don't really see it necessarily as the sport itself, but it's also what it provides you. It gives you a training structure, which is giving you the opportunity for you to do sports, which I understand all this concept of like having to be physically healthy to be also mentally healthy. And the training itself pushes me to do sports and keep myself fit. So that's actually pretty good. But also at the same time, I think it's a way to also train my mind, because all the sparring involves, in my opinion, to confront a complex and difficult situation. And you need, or you have to be under control and relaxed in order to be able to perform. So I also saw that as an opportunity to improve. And I was pretty glad I did that. I can also see, as compared to before, just the benefits I get just by doing this. I get how happy I am, how mindful I can become, how relaxed I can be. I've seen like a massive improvement since I've started doing this. But but at the same time, it's not just sports. It also gives me an opportunity to interact, make friends, get along with my teammates in the boxing club. But also, as you were saying, in terms of emotional, I am trying to be conscious about making an effort to talk to my friends, particularly my friends that I no longer live with. So my American friends, my friends back in Barcelona, my friends back here in Malaga, my friends that I met in Oxford, but now they're gone too. You know, Oxford's a small academic city, so like the turnover of people is very, very, very high. And I think that's important because you could just look at us as this kind of like a machine or whatever. Like we have different needs and you need to grow and you need to provide all these different things using the analogy of a plant instead of the machine, which I think the plant is a bit better because of the organic growth. You know, you need sun, you need water, you need temperature. So this is the same things. We need sports to be physically healthy. We need friends because we're social beings. And on this part, I've noticed that it's not the same spending time alone than it is actually engaging with your friends. Plus, the community that you can get out of them long term, I think it's amazing. And lastly, what you said, also the information one, that one is also the two sides of the same coin. The information one, which is first, my curiosity, and I tend to be really curious, and when I spend my time, in fact, I procrastinate more like reading news than I do with other things. But at the same time, it's something that spurs your creativity, since it's basically more things that you throw at the back of your mind, and more things you learn, more things you know, that allows you to kind of like keep moving. So it helps me to get balance, and it also helps me to keep myself sane. Because this allows me to learn and know about other things, not just my work. Because if not, like, you know, can you imagine like working 10 hours, 12 hours a day? And then if you don't have anything else, then you just completely, your life becomes your work, or your work becomes your life. So this actually helps me a lot too.
In terms of the information, can you think of any particular examples when it has helped you follow along a conversation that otherwise you wouldn't have been able to follow because it wasn't on your field, and maybe something that led you to some creative projects with people from like cross-disciplinary projects?
Actually, it's funny, but there's not just one instance. It's actually, in fact, my whole PhD. In my lab, my supervisor's lab, they're working on this particular DNA-made nanomachines. And they wanted me to see if I could just, you know, I could merge it with the biological world into like more applications within cells and everything. So I always had to find my way through all these muddy things, which is basically the limits of one field and the other one, where one field becomes the other. So in fact, through collaborations, listening to people, talking to people, reading by myself, I started to come up with different ideas that in the end I had started testing by talking to other people. And I started to develop my own sense of what should I be doing. And in fact, I learned about the CRISPR technique by talking to some friend of mine back in Boston. He introduced me about the whole topic, how important that is. And I started thinking on, okay, after this new information, what can I do with this? Or another collaborator that works with drug delivery and thinking, what can I do? Is this of interest to me? Can I do something with this?
Can you talk a bit more about this technique you mentioned?
CRISPR is basically a revolutionary technology that is based on a proto immune system that bacteria have. And it's basically, just think about it as a molecular scissor. What it is revolutionary is that in order to do genetic engineering, you need to know what do you want to cut, and being very sure and very precise that you're cutting what you want to cut. The technologies that we had before weren't as precise, nor as simple, nor as cheap as this technique is. And what it has created is now an environment in which like any researcher can introduce genetic changes in cells in order to study different diseases, to understand better biology, or even to develop new therapies in an affordable, easy, and precise way. And that has a huge potential for not only learning and unraveling new knowledge, but at the same time, the potential to create new therapies and even a new era of like how we look at ourselves.
Is there any particular example of this that has been taken into practice that we all might know?
Not necessarily at the moment, but like what you could think of at the idea with this is harnessing this technology in a safe way, which is exactly where we are at the moment. We're trying to understand, can we do this properly and is this safe to do? The idea of introducing and modifying genes. So the whole idea is like somebody with a genetic disease may be able to reverse that. So for example, think about one example is muscular atrophies like Duchenne muscular atrophy and stuff. It's a very powerful technique to change this. There's no a particular example, or I would say a particularly good example at the moment. There's okay. A bit of bad talk, I would say, recently.
Okay, I would like to hear more about the work that you have been doing and you're mm-hmm. doing right now in a bit. I mm-hmm. want to come back to the topic of information and yeah. ask you, what are your sources? So mm-hmm. what do you usually read? Maybe later you can comment on some book recommendations.
I read a lot of the news, just plain old news, just like newspapers and stuff like that. I spent a lot of time on the Guardian website, Axios, El País too. And I like to get a sense of what's going on because while it's also important to know what's going on, it also spurs me to learn different things. For example, they were talking about something happening on the economy, then it sets me to learn a bit more, like, wait, what do they mean by this? Kind of learn more. And the more I think of it, and the more I learn, the more I realize that actual information is a weapon, right? Like you can use information to make people do what you want, and the more information you have and the more information you control, the more resistant you are to this kind of manipulation. Also, with all this talk about fake news, the more you know, the easier it is for you to discern what's real and not real. So I read a lot of newspapers, but at the same time, I spend a lot of time on my journals, my academic journals like Nature Science, ACS Nanoletters, Nature Biotechnology, you name them. But at the same time, I also like get into other sources like TechCrunch, Vox Medium, like that they can give you that. And something I've been noticing that a lot of people spend a lot of time in social media. I noticed that I'm not really use that much of social media myself, but what I try to do, for example, I don't really use Facebook anymore, but when I connect, I have liked many pages of like, you know, Harvard Business Review, like MIT Technology Review, and things like this. So in the end, all these social media also helps me to keep track of things that may be happening because of like seeing updates and everything. And then you just follow all these links to get your information from my work to things happening in the AI world to things are happening, I don't know, climate change, everything. So just use that to have a broad picture of things.
And how do you avoid getting distracted or overwhelmed?
That is actually something I've been thinking of. I should be better at it. I'm not as good as I would like to be. But normally, I find these times because during my workday, if I am doing an experiment, I may have, I don't know, a 45-minute break because I am doing something and I need to wait for 30 minutes to something to happen and then move on to the next step. So what I use my time normally is to like put my notes, make sure that everything is fine, work on a different thing. But sometimes if it's not 30 minutes, it's 10 minutes, I really don't have much time sometimes to do anything. So I use maybe some of the time I use this to like, you know, check the news and everything. So in a way, this chunk time system is a way to control that I don't go too farther down because I know that I only have 10 minutes. So I read it for 10 minutes and then off I go. So avoiding the temptation sometimes works best for me, that because if I get in, it could just like, you know, time can pass really fast.
I would like to hear a bit more about previous sports that maybe you have done, how what you do now is different from that, and if you have been doing or if you do any meditation or any activities mm-hmm. that you consider meditative moments in your week or in your day.
So sports, well, I would say that while I consider myself somebody active, I've never done like massive amounts of sports in my life, like at least not as serious as I've done them. I'm doing them now. And right now I'm not even an amazing athlete or anything like that, but I definitely have done my running. I've definitely done my exercise, but other instances in which I've done a more dedicated sport. I mean, I went to Oxford, right? So I had to try rowing. So at least, for example, like now I can say like, yeah, I rowed for a bit. But that was fun because it was a team and involved a lot of work in the water, which I realized I liked. But it wasn't probably kind of like thinking, oh my God, I need to find a sport and do this. I also used to do a bit of skateboard, but not like a bit of longboard, but I was terrible at it. But like, you know, it was also good to like get out, do some sport, do some physical activity, meet friends, do stuff. So those are normally the things I used to do. Nothing too serious as much as I've been doing now. Regarding the meditation, as you said, I would say not at the moment. I don't do at the moment. However, I'm working on it. I am interested on mindfulness or mindful meditation. I have this book. It's called Mindful Meditation. I think like it was called A Guide for like a Frantic World or something. It's I can give you the details later. I'm really terrible at the name of like the authors. But the whole idea is like it explains meditation in the context of not necessarily spiritual, but more as a tool to actually realize that we can have different ways in which we can confront things that happen to us. And this meditation helps us to be more relaxed and be better at stuff. And in fact, it's a small course for like 8 weeks, which is what I'm starting to try to do at the moment.
More like a technique than yeah. a religious practice yeah. or a spiritual practice.
Exactly. I do understand now the power of, like, as you were saying, the meditative practices. And it's something that I kind of do, but in my own way. For example, I found, for example, that for me, what it works a lot is to have a slow morning, have my breakfast and be more slow at it. And which allows me in the end, I think that at the beginning, I thought it was more of a, oh yeah, I'm just basically being lazy, Antonio, you should wake up earlier, do better stuff. But now looking at it, what I'm actually doing is giving me a bit of space to declutter, space to think, space to be on my own and then go out there. And I think that there's a big difference between those days that I can have my own slow breakfast than those that I just have to just run.
This is great. I would like to hear more about your habits or like daily rituals. Do you have any set schedule? Do you kind of leave it as it goes? Or how do you do how does a day in your life look like when you're living in Oxford and working?
I would say that I have a structure, a general structure, like a bit of an skeleton, and like I normally then improv as I go. Because while I have an idea, which are, for example, experiments I want to do in a day or everything, then I also sometimes give more time to myself to do things or more space to do those experiment stuff because they always take more than you think they will. And also realizing that in the end, the more experiments I can do, the more information I have. And with the more information I have, the better future decisions I can do in terms of my work. So normally my days tend to be pretty long. So what I do now is to try to find within that day my own space. So for example, I try to actually give myself a space in the mornings, as I said. So wake up, make my breakfast and enjoy my breakfast while maybe reading the news and just think for a bit and then eventually go to work. Sometimes I have training in the mornings, so I wake up a bit earlier, go training, and then I shortened my breakfast because, of course, I've already dedicated time to my to training in the morning. But I try to do that, get some space for myself, and then let it a bit more to flow, a bit more natural. Because if I'm feeling that I'm pushing myself, I might as well do it the way that is most natural to me, not cramp it or force it.
Would you consider your life simple, and what things could make it easier?
I definitely consider my life simple. I mean, I may do complex stuff, but in the end, the mentality behind it and what I need to do and everything, it's simple. Like, you know, you wake up, you go to work, you do your things, you improve your stuff. So in the end, it's a pretty simple life in terms that a lot of people will have a very similar lifestyle too. The thing is just in the end, the nuances of the difference of the work I do. That is simple to me because that's exactly what I do. It may be complex to other people, but I do feel it's simple. But something I just wanted to point is this simple doesn't mean it's easy. It's actually pretty demanding. So while simple, I try to manage a bit the demands of my life, which are things that I can do to even simplify, as you said, my life more. It would be a bit more planning, but what I feel that particularly work, since it's actually such a chunk of my day-to-day life, is synergy with and collaboration with other people. Because sometimes the kind of projects I try to do, they're pretty large. So there is so much I can do by myself. So if I am on my own, that actually means a trade-off with time. I'm going to take longer. So I do believe that a good way to simplify my life is actually collaboration. And I think that that is actually also something that applies to many other different things and practices that you could do that. Also, I would say that is prioritizing. There's this concept of the 80-20 rule that, like, you know, just 20% of the things you do sometimes yield 80% of your results. So just trying to focus on making sure at each time what is the most important thing that you need to do short term and long term, and prioritize those.
Could you tell us about the work that you have been doing in your PhD and the work you're doing now in plain English, something that we can all understand, and maybe also comment on the implications that it might have or not on the lives of, of, like, I mean, on the world in general, not on the life of researchers, but more in our daily lives?
So I would say the biggest topic that I work, I have several projects, so they are more or less kind of like a Venn diagram. They kind of like touch each other, and there's like this overlap between them. But I would say that the biggest topic is drug delivery. What drug delivery is how you make sure that your active compound gets to the right place, to the site of action, so that you can have the maximum effect with the least amount of side effects. That is for our typical concept of drugs, like, you know, paracetamol and stuff. An example is that you need to take a lot of it so that enough of it makes it, let's say, to your brain, which is to treat your like headache or something like that. But then there's also other kinds of drugs that have a huge potential to treat genetic disorders, cancer, many things, that they're so big and so difficult to get them to they need to go, that you need to help them to get there. So it's the equivalent of like putting like a little car to them to reach their destination. So what I work on is how can you make these drugs to get when they need to, where they need to go. But the way I'm approaching this is really understanding how does this work in the context of the body. You can use these little cars to get your the drugs that you're interested to whatever you need to. But the problem that you're always going to be having is that you want them to, for example, let's say you want them to go to the brain, but just only a small portion of them will make it there. So one of the topics I work on is how can I make better delivery systems? How can I make better cars that they can actually reach what they need to go? And for that, you need to have an understanding of like what are the key players on the process by which these cars go in your body and how they make it to the brain and how can you improve that. At the same time, that is one way in which you could look at it. But the problem that you will always have, or the problem that we're facing at the moment, is that it's very difficult to get, let's say, perfect accumulation. You will never have, or at least at the moment, it's very difficult to get all the drug that you put in somebody else's body to get to the brain. It will always go somewhere else. And in some cases, you know, that's okay. We can tolerate that. That's fine. But in other cases that may be dangerous or really undesirable. So that is something else that we need to work on. And that is the other topic I work on. How can I make our drugs smart? Because if you cannot really get them, all of them exactly where you want, maybe you need the drug to know that it's in the right place. So I'm working on making smart drugs that they have the ability to understand, hey, have I reached the destination I should be in? Am I? And if it's a yes, then they become active and they do their thing. If they understand, okay, I'm not where I should be, then they're off. Therefore, they won't produce any effect. And on that is where I worked on, as I said before, on a CRISPR technique that hopefully will help it to become more tissue specific when you use it in the body. Regarding the last question that you said on how this will impact people in their daily lives, I would say it's the potential of all these technologies, particularly drug delivery. Forget about the CRISPR, but just the whole concept of getting the drug that you need, where it needs to go, making it the maximum effect with the least amount of side effects, I think is something we can all understand the value of it. It's safer drugs. And on top of that, new family of drugs that can actually treat things that was very difficult for us to do something about before. So it kind of become a more specific and safer kind of drugs. Yeah.
On our previous conversation, you also mentioned genetic engineering.
Genetic engineering, in this case, would be basically how could you get the sequence that you have in the genes and modify it. Some diseases may actually be caused by mutations that we have in there. And the problem with the mutations that you have and all these problems that you have in these genes is that since they are producing something wrong because they have this change over there, you can use a drug, but it will be always transient, like a treatment. It won't never be a cure. So with genetic engineering, what you need to do is what you're trying to do is actually reach to the cause of the problem and trying to change it. However, because of how powerful this is and the many gains that you could get by changing other people's genes, is also very dangerous. Like, you know, modifying the wrong gene can produce effects that you don't want. So it is a very, very powerful technique, and we are all moving there. We want it or not, we're getting there. Everything is moving in that direction at the moment. It's just how long it's going to take until we can do this on a more mainstream application that at the moment I don't really know. But the bottom line of this is imagine a genetic disease that sometimes, or they don't have a treatment, or they don't even have a cure, and being able to just cure it. And I don't know, for example, cystic fibrosis, just changing that, somebody being cured of it instead of managing the disease. So it's a powerful, powerful field to work on.
Could you point out a specific example of some alteration that you could make to the genes of a preborn?
That is very tricky, particularly because of all the moral implications that have. Should we or should we not be doing it? And what would happen once we create a technology that you could use to modify an embryo and make changes that actually will, if monitored properly, applies to the whole body, even though, you know, there are other cases that doesn't happen. So that's the complicated bits. Which changes can we do? You know, you need to think of the problem that changing genes is not like something that sometimes you can just change by saying, I change gene A and I get this effect. There are some cases in which you can get that. But other times, like for example, when people say, oh, we're going to change these genes so I can make my child taller or smarter or things like that. Sure, I think we will get there. But at the moment, it's not just a simple, easy, one-off thing. It's a complicated system in which, like, we need to understand the interplay between so many different genes that at the moment, it would be very hard to do. But things that are, in principle, easy to us at the moment are manageable, right? There was a case recently of a Chinese researcher that said and claimed that he modified some embryos and actually took the pregnancy to term. So they actually being born. We don't know exactly what actually happened with that. What he said is like he changed one gene that is involved in HIV infection, and the whole idea would be to prevent the child from getting infected. It was a terrible idea, but like that's not what we're discussing at the moment.
Is there any contribution that you have in mind that you would like to do in your field?
What I'm working on in the end, so as I said, I have this drug delivery, better vehicles, so we can get more where they need to go. And also the other area of like how I can make the drug to know, am I in the right place or not? So in the end, if you mix both of them together, the contribution I want to make is more specific, safer drugs, but basically like the concept of tissue and cell specificity, like how can I make sure that I have something where it needs to go? That's the contribution I'm working on.
And this might be a dumb question. Would the alteration be on the actual drug that you provide? So maybe make an alteration to paracetamol and then you change the composition, and then the composition is more prone to go to certain areas in the body of anyone? Or how would that happen?
Well, the first thing is the concept of drug, right? Like, you know, you can have a drug, it could be a small molecule like paracetamol, or in some cases it can be something big such a protein like an antibody. So like, you know, the concept is pretty large. It's in fact, as you're saying, yes, you would modify the compound itself in some cases, like the one that would know where is it, if it's in the right place or not. Yes, that you will change the compound to make it smart, if you will. If not, it's the other way around. You're changing the car, which is basically where the drug is enclosed to reach to the destination.
Before we continue, is there anywhere online that people maybe can find more about this or maybe connect with you?
Well, I would actually have to update my LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, that's the best way to find me at the moment. Yeah, so using my name as we described before.
When do you think you get your best work done?
I normally think my best work is done normally in the mornings. And that is after I actually had, as I said, this slow morning starter. It allows me to kind of like enter with a bit more of the right intention to do my stuff. But then again, it really depends on which is the work I have at hand. If it's experimental work, which is basically manual labor, then the only thing I need to be is focused enough that I don't mess up what I'm doing. And that normally is like anytime I have enough caffeine in my body. But the other bit, which is more creative, when you have a problem and I need to come up with it, I would say that the best times I do that is actually not really when I am focusing too much on it. I noticed all these things that people say that you come up with new ideas in the back of your mind. I completely relate to this. There are times that you're discussing with people, you've come across new pieces of information, and then eventually, you know, it kind of pops in your mind, kind of saying, what about this? And for that, normally I notice that only happens when I have the best balance I can have. That goes back to what we were discussing about doing sports, being in touch with my friends and everything. When I am okay, is much easier for my brain to actually all do these connections.
Are there any exciting projects that you or your colleagues at Oxford are working on?
Yes, there are plenty, actually, at least to me. Again, as I was saying, my work tends to be in the collaboration between different fields and a bit on the limits between different disciplines. So on one side, I collaborate with a lab focused on something called extracellular vesicles or exosomes. And this is basically a new drug delivery system that there's a lot of money now moving into making this a reality, particularly into small startup companies such as Evox that actually were spun out by this collaborator, Professor Matthew Wood. And the best way to understand that is like they are taking this way cells naturally communicate with each other. They make these tiny bubbles filled with information inside. And they are trying to basically see how can we harness these little bubbles to put things in it and use it to deliver drugs. Also, can we use this to treat complex diseases like, you know, tissue regeneration, like after, for example, a heart disease, or can we take this to deliver things to the brain and all that kind of stuff. And that is my collaborator, but like in my supervisor's lab, they work on this concept of DNA nanotechnology and just the best way of thinking of it. Just imagine using DNA to basically build machines on the nanoscale, like really tiny, tiny, tiny machines. So one project there, they're working a lot on it. They're trying to understand how to make structures out of RNA. And the important thing of this, what is this important thing out of RNA, is that you can then put this information into a cell. And if you do that, then the cell will produce this machine. So imagine a machine that goes inside the cells, goes finding something or goes to repair something else. And then you just put, like, you have a gene for your machine, and then you can just put it in the cell. The cell produces it, it folds, makes the machine out of it, and then off it goes and it does its action. So just this cool idea of like nano engineering within a cell, that's actually something they're working on too.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. From my current role as a software developer, I can see the analogy, right? When we try to automate or to change behaviors of programs that we've been using for a long time, and we see friction or things that don't work properly. I mean, we kind of consume in some way those kind of, not drugs, right? Like we have some programs that you then install in your computer, and then it makes everything work in a completely different way that hopefully sometimes simplifies our use of it, even though it's more complex than before. So what's happening is more complex. Can you touch a bit on what technologies you work with that allow you to do your research?
Well, about technologies, as you said, mostly like of the stuff that I use is not pretty demanding. And so many cases, what I use the most is like Excel, I would say. But like I also use for my CRISPR work, I use some like computation, particularly modeling suites. They're actually already online. There's called, for example, this one called NUPAC. You use that to simulate how your piece of nucleic acid looks like when you look at it, because it can have different structures and the structures may affect something, functionality and everything. So I use that. In my case, it's more plain old experiments, but my coworkers do definitely use much more simulation work than I do. They also work on different packages for understanding how these machines actually are made and how can you actually make sure that you got what you have. And going back to what you were saying regarding software engineering and everything, I see that here there is a huge potential for understanding what we're doing. In fact, that's what a lot of people call in silico, when you are making work on a computer and designing things on a computer and then go. In fact, in the field of DNA nanotechnology, it's very common to have this computational tools like Cat Nano, this is the name of a very well-known program, used to design a DNA nanostructure, and then it tells you which are the components you need, and then you just buy them, mix them together, and then you get exactly what you need and what you want. It's amazing. In fact, on this field, there is a lot of people that trained as computer scientists and then jumped into this field too. Also with the concept of biology that I'm talking about, is a concept of synthetic biology. It's the whole idea of also like programming cells to do something, and then how can you give them instructions to then perform some kind of logical computation, like pretty simple, like AND gates or gates or something, and then do that. So I agree, like while we have at the moment pretty simple tools, but then you can see how new technologies are spreading into the field. Yes,
I guess that when you mention AND gates or gates is some sort of conditional behavior, right? Yeah. When something happens, they act in a way, mm-hmm. or a different way. So touching on technology in general, mm-hmm. what do you see as a healthy relationship with technology?
Well, the way I understand technology is that technology is actually a tool. We need to understand what we want or what we need this tool for. I understand that a healthy relationship is basically when you are in control of that tool and not the other way around, when the tool is controlling you. I've been reading lately about it and how actually a lot of the concept of phone addiction, social media addiction, apart from all the addictive behavior that is built upon, also I think it's a way that it helps us not confronting some of the things, and it's actually giving us something that soothes underlying problem. So you can just flip the problem around and understand that if you are maybe spending a lot of time in a non-productive manner with technology, you could use that as an indicator, thinking, okay, what am I hiding from and what I need to do in order to improve it, to discover it. So a healthy relationship for me would be something in which you use technology for what it's intended for, when you need it and for what you needed it. Everything else that it's the other way around, then I think it maybe it's not good.
And aside from technology, what things do you do, maybe analog, maybe creative, maybe some other things that you do to disconnect?
The ones I like the most in the end sometimes is actually take a walk, just going around, walk for around a bit. I spend a lot of time when I go to work on my bike, sometimes just going around on my bike, that actually helps a lot too. And at least luckily, and it's a privilege to be in a city which is so full of parks. So actually allows me sometimes to just go for a walk, go for a run, not within an urban environment, which actually I think it's good to just have the change of scenery that actually helps disconnect from the rest. I like to read. I don't read as much as I would like to. I kind of also something that helps. And music, like probably 99% of the rest of the world, just going around there with like your own music and walking and thinking. Those are, I would say, the analog things I may do to disconnect, as you said. But in the end, anything that allows me to focus on something so that you could maybe enter this, what they call like this kind of flow state kind of thing, that you can just focus hard enough that you don't think of anything else, but like not as much engaged so that your mind can also go around. So yeah, making pizza maybe. Yeah, making pizza dough and then eating it. That's actually also pretty good. Yeah.
Can you touch on some books that have had an impact in your life and help you forge your way of thinking?
Okay, so there's this book I read maybe a year ago, something like that, called Deep Work by Cole Newport. I think it's a pretty good book. I think it helps a lot to understand really what's going on. And that boils down again to what I was talking about, this holistic approach to myself, like friends, sports, mind and everything. You need to understand, I think that the takeaway message from that book is like, what do you want to do? Work. Which kind of work do you need to do? Creative. How does this creativity thrive? And then invest on your ability to get more creative work done. We put a lot of effort and a lot of value onto results. But then we forget that actually results come after a whole process. So I think that that's the key bit on this book, is like really understanding how is actually your work done so that you can actually create the right environment for you to produce the best. Then results will come out of that. But people tend to do the other way around. They focus so much onto results and onto just managing things and accomplish things that in the end, sometimes it just simply doesn't work. And I think that was very well explained on that book. Then the course I was talking about, mindfulness beforehand, not necessarily as a tool, but like the first introductory chapters. I mean, I'm at the beginning, so I've only read like one or two chapters. But I think that something that really helps a lot is also because it provides an understanding on how feelings and thoughts go around and how actually does have an impact on how you perform. Because in the end, you know, you as we were saying, you're planned, you have your growth. So if they change your lightning and you need a lot of sun and then they put you in the shade, you're not going to grow. So it's the same thing. It's really understanding how everything from an holistic point of view, how can that affect you? And I think that that is also something pretty nice. But that is onto books, more onto the way of thinking. Then, of course, there is like other, like more silly books around. Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned deep work. For me, it was a highly transformative read that I did at the end of 2016, right before starting to work on my master's thesis. And it really changed the way I approached it. I would love to hear about how it transformed the structure of your days to work, or if you can touch upon particular things you now see differently or now you don't do. And yeah, this is a great thing that you named it. I recently saw that Jocelyn Cakelive released a podcast interview with him 3 days ago, January 1st, 2019, on his new book called Digital Minimalism. So I would recommend all the listeners to read all. I mean, I've read So Good They Can't Ignore You and Deep Work so far, and I'm waiting for the release of the new one. I would really recommend it. So can you mention how it changed your way of looking at your day to day?
The way it helped me is understanding how my work is done, how I can have the maximum impact. And actually, I had the wrong approach beforehand. I was very focused on the creating results, like working, spending time in the lab. And I think that what that book taught me a lot was about two things. In order to get the right amount of the right kind of work, you need to know exactly what you're doing. And in order to do that, you need to be in the right headspace. And the way I was doing my work at the time was probably not going to yield the best ideas or the best hypotheses to continue. So I would say that the way it changed me was the way I tackled my problems. Right now, what I normally do, something that I do much better right now, is like how I plan my stuff, but also at the same time, how taking time off to the point of like, you know, I have a problem, just let's go somewhere else and think of it and not worry too much of like, oh, I'm not being maybe productive at the time. I think that that's actually the biggest contributor, because actually it's not off time. It's actually work and time you need in order to get everything done. So yeah, probably the way I look at things, it changed a lot after that.
How do you measure your personal success?
Okay, that's a hard question, but I would say that I measure my personal success not by results, but by attaining my personal goals. Before I was much more focused on measuring success by getting things done, like, oh, I've got this, I got that. Right now, I think it's the opposite. It's, can I feel or do I feel that am I doing everything I can and everything I can from a realistic point of view? Am I working on getting better? If I'm doing those things, I think I'm being successful, because it's exactly the necessary ingredients in order then to get results. Many of the other results, like, you know, getting the right experiment to work or getting this paper or getting a patent and stuff, sometimes those things don't really depend on myself. So I'm trying to measure my own success and my own worth by things that may be out of my control. I've noticed that I'm so much better now that I try not to do that too much.
Yeah, I agree. I think focusing more on your day-to-day progress and measuring your success, comparing yourself to yesterday or what you hadn't done this morning, rather than comparing yourself to other external measures or comparison with other people, will remove a lot of the overwhelming thoughts from your mind. And I'm personally trying to do that as much as I can, because as you say, rewards come sometimes by chance, by luck, and we don't really expect them. So we might better be lucky of the ones that we get than be expecting ones and then be disappointed of not receiving them or getting the, I don't know, people acclaiming our work in the ways we want or things like that. Of course, I mean, I still think that we should aim for certain things, right? But not obsess about them.
But that is, as you said, aim, go in a general direction more than define that general direction by the things that you get, not the things that you're doing. So
could you mention any role models of people that you have, maybe writers, friends, colleagues?
Something I'm trying to do now is not having role models. Of course I have role models, but I've noticed that nobody can really have the whole package. So what I'm trying to do now, for example, is trying to look at the, when I'm talking to people, try to learn from everybody as much as I can, because they will have things that they are so much better than I am at, and try to learn where this comes from and everything. So more than have a particular thing that will lead me to just mimic this person, I try to see where these traits I may be interested in learning or improving upon, where they come from, what do these people do to get it done. So more than a specific role model, I would say that what I try to do is more focusing on how the people around me do the things I want to do. Of course, I have role models like Robert Langer, for example, like great scientist, but like, you know, that is like the equivalent of like having that a huge idol as your role model. Like, I think it's great, but like in a more realistic and day-to-day life, I think it's better to find examples around you. Yeah.
If you could send snail mail to everyone for them to read some sentence tomorrow, what would it say? What would be your message to the world?
It would be probably about acceptance, and acceptance with the mentality of like evolving and growing, growth and acceptance, and how in order to grow, you need to accept what your situation is, because once you accept who you are, where you are, what your circumstances are, where you come from, is the moment that you can start working towards your goals. And again, I feel that it's actually growth, what we should be all working towards, being better and improving ourselves. However, improving and bettering ourselves from a way that is meaningful to you. So once you have this concept of acceptance and you know where you are already on your starting line, and then you can go whatever. And anywhere that is good to you, it should be all that matters.
Are there any last recommendations or comments that you want to do to our listeners?
Yeah, I think it's again on the work-life balance that we were talking before. I think I just wanted to emphasize, because I don't remember exactly if I was clear enough, is the holistic approach to everything related to work. We believe sometimes that everything that matters is just our work, or we get defined ourselves by the activity that we do. But it's again, all the other things do matter. Even if, for example, your driving force and what you actually, your biggest ambition is becoming the best on your particular job, you still need to take care of yourself in order to be able to perform at 100%. And the thing is, sustaining 100% for a long time is very hard. That is the only way I can just do that, is by understanding that working more doesn't mean working better. And for that, you need, in my case, I need physical activity, get my friends rest, and understanding that, in fact, I'm not wasting my time, or I'm not slacking off if I am not all the time working. Is in fact, I think, understanding that you do need to disconnect more often, and you need to take care of yourself if you actually want to make it there. So after seeing during my PhD, like a lot of, like, I would say, toxic relationships with work and everything. So yeah, it's good to, you sometimes think that people know it, but I've realized that it's easy to say it, but very hard to do.
That was an amazing wrap up. Antonio and I had a previous conversation. He has these three pillars, right? Or mainly two, that support his intellectual efforts. And I think that we can all benefit from, you know, like looking for physical exercise outside of work, maintaining sanity by fostering our emotional connections, and also being informed, that's something that I'm probably bad at, being informed about many different fields and topics. Because, I mean, I've seen it already that cross-disciplinary projects are the ones that are more fruitful and more powerful to communicate to others. And I think being informed about the whole spectrum of what's going on, not only around your field, but in general, is pretty good. So yeah, I would just stop here. I think like we've covered a long way. So do you want to add anything?
Just on that very last bit that you just said on cross-discipline, the activity of working between different disciplines is in fact how creativity happens. You need to know new things so we can find new connections. And it's these new connections that are actually how you foster creativity. And I find that getting informed, debating with other people, discussing and repeat is exactly how you get those new things. And they should be obvious. Once they come over there, they become obvious and you even feel bad about them because it seems so obvious at the time. But yeah, it's pretty good. It's creativity, what you were just describing.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Antonio.
It was a pleasure. Yeah.
Thanks to you, the listener, for being with us today. You can find Antonio by searching Antonio Garcia Guerra online. He'll probably have some homework to update LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And yeah, again, thanks for being here. It's been my pleasure.
Anytime. It was great to be here and have this great conversation with you, Nono.
Well, once again, I'm Nono Martinez Alonso, and this is the Getting Simple podcast. You can find a detailed list of episode notes at gettingsimple.com/podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. See you on the next episode.
See you guys.
Bye.
Hey guys, this is Antonio Garcia again. I just wanted to let you know that Nono and I had some cheeky questions we recorded after our interview. Please tune up to the Getting Simple podcast and you should be able to listen to them. So that was it. Goodbye, guys. Thank you for tuning up.